Well, it's really great to see all of you, although I'm not really seeing you. But those of you who are studying the precepts with us, this afternoon we'll be studying the sixth grave precept, not to speak of the faults of others, or as Norman states it in his yin yang way, not to speak of others' faults, but to speak out of loving kindness. So we might think of this precept, not to speak of others' faults, as pretty simple, and not to give it a lot of thought, shrug it off like, well, of course, this is just human decency. I knew I was going to speak to this precept way before the election last November, so I've had plenty of time to think about it. Even my mentioning the election has started the ringing of alarm bells for many of you, I'm sure. I'm not going to speak of others' faults. What else do I have to talk about? Others' faults are splayed across the news daily, hourly. Blame seems to be the drop-jawed, unbelievable state of affairs. I might even borrow from Marianne on the last precept and relabel it, this precept, as don't gossip, or a bodhisattva does not gossip. So I'm really struggling as a Buddhist to comprehend what is currently right in front of me. I'm beginning to see a bigger picture, a picture of disruption, where after the immediate effects of disruption comes a restructuring. As an environmentalist and an activist in climate change activities, I'm looking for something in biomimicry, where growth can begin to take shape, like seeing wildflowers and new trees after a fire. New growth. I'm not sitting back and just watching it all take place. With this firestorm, we are all firemen, or firewomen, or fire people. I don't want to get too far off topic, the topic of not speaking of the faults of others, even if I'm environmentally and culturally inundated right now with it. So I'll give you a breather. Just remember, we've been through this before as a divided nation in our own lifetimes with the Vietnam War. So, one of the things that really stands out to me in this precept is how we hold a sense of another person, especially with consideration of that person's shortcomings. Simply put, we pigeonhole that person, not allowing for growth or change. I have been so guilty of this myself, and it was one of the main observations that I had about monastic institutions. Holding people in pigeonholed spaces does not allow for growth and actually can blind us to that person's growth when it is happening. We are in a monastic training for spiritual growth. We might see someone as selfish or lazy and let that define the person in our mind. If we share that and others also share that view or begin to see someone in that light, we do real harm. For me, a not so harmful lesson in this was judging someone to have no artistic talent. I had created a community pottery space in Santa Cruz in the 70s, which I turned into a pottery co-op. One day, an acquaintance of mine from UCSC brought a pot to me he wanted fired. He'd made it in a pottery class, and I knew most of the students in these classes. The pot had a series of gorillas hanging from the rim, each alike. And I fired it for him, but I was thinking, oh, brother, is this guy going nowhere? He later moved in as a roommate with a very famous sculptor who was teaching at the university. His work changed so dramatically that I was blown away. His work in no way resembled the sculptor's work. He was making 6 foot tall, pit fired porcelain pots that were drop dead beautiful. I'd come across his name in famous gallery openings in San Francisco. To me, this was a lesson in you never know. And time again, I've had my perceptions disabused. Nowadays, I almost expect it whenever I find myself starting to make a judgment or begin to pigeonhole somebody. So for me, the question becomes, can I change? Can I keep this precept uppermost in my mind long enough for it to hone my intentions and my behavior? This speaks to self-awareness, to know myself and being awake to my actions and thoughts. I saw another version of this precept stated thus: see the perfection. Do not speak of others' errors and faults. See the perfection. I like that. Seeing our Buddha nature in everyone. Now, don't scoff, thinking of someone who I might consider mentally ill. Beneath the senescence, there's actually a being capable, theoretically, of recognizing this suffering, their own, and then perhaps the suffering that person is inflicting on others. It may be an extreme example, easier to apply to someone not so far gone. So please think about the seeing that perfection when you may be pigeonholing a person by their errors. Do I really need to blame others? Now I'm thinking of my most recent positions about current events. It is so obvious what is going on now that I want to step back from reacting to try to see a big picture. There's a major disturbance going on here, like a firestorm wiping out forests around Tal Sahara or Los Angeles' loss of whole neighborhoods. What will now have a chance to grow? What will fill this void that is being created? We're all firefighters here taking action instead of just sitting back and watching the news. I just read an article about corporate programs around DEI. Corporate giving is being scrutinized from within and without, and 89% of corporations will still continue to give, but they may reword their mission statements so that this just becomes a war of semantics. McDonald's may no longer give to someone with at least one Hispanic parent, but they will give grants to benefit the Hispanic community, or something to that effect. Big corporations will still be looking for new hires that give a damn. Looking at this precept again, we can see how speaking of the faults of others in the monastery can be harmful, not just to that person, but to the whole sangha, especially to ourselves, because this kind of behavior is the antithesis of what the Buddha taught. It stunts our own growth as a wannabe bodhisattva. I think we all want to be bodhisattvas. And you know what? You are. In a monastery, we're talking about a small community, so we can see the precept playing out in a lab-like situation, looking at it through a microscope in a monastic petri dish. Mostly, we are not now living in a monastery. We are in a much more diffuse world. Community. Each of us is in our own community with not a lot of commonality with our Sangha. We have a Zoom Sangha with a few crossovers here in the Bay Area. And it's wonderful to see each other in person at one day sittings and Wednesday hybrid at seminars. So here in our lay communities, the precept has to be internalized, held, examined, reflected on, and attempt to see it in our responses to who and what we encounter. Even under more of a microscopic view, is within the confines of our own family units. What a minefield that is. Here is where most of our interactions take place, where the most irritations can take hold, where we begin to concretize our situations. Until we reach out to therapists to help us reframe our situations and air out what we've pent up. It's where we get such a wonderful opportunity to pay attention to what is happening in the moment, noticing where in our body are we experiencing the moment. As a cured asthmatic, I always notice when I'm catching my breath, holding it for a moment as I ponder how to respond. Smiling next really helps me find the compassionate response. Holding love, not anger, as my intention. We don't need to go through life as automatons. Push this button and get this response. We can cut through, not holding to fixed views. I've been reading Robin Wall Kimmerer's new book, The Service Berry, a slim book which is all about reciprocity, giving gifts and receiving gifts, about appreciating the earth and what it gives us, but also about economics in an alternative view of the gifting economy. We all experience a gifting economy of reciprocity that perhaps we take for granted. Libraries are a gift. And then there are those efforts by private citizens who create small street giveaway libraries. On my street, we're notified when someone has grown too much food, and we're welcome to come and pick up lemons, apples, pears, or dare I say, zucchini. Norman spoke last Wednesday of this reciprocity as affinity. Affinity with the triple treasure of taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. At any rate, I recommend Service Berry as a great book for this time in America. She asks, might there be a cultivation of gratitude be part of the solution to having a sense of scarcity and want? Scarcity and want are the usual definition of economics, but Kimmerer wants us to see having an attitude of sufficiency. I see the sense of sufficiency in the Buddha Dharma. In light of our sufficiency, what need have we to speak of the faults of others? We can appreciate our sufficiency in a very profound manner, letting it enclose us in a sense of ease and appreciation of others in their fullness. Norman would have us speak out of loving kindness. I think this precept gives us a real chance at self-awareness. Gossip comes so naturally to us that if we are not to speak of others or of all the interesting fixes we and our friends find ourselves in, we might be stumped for something to say. If we sit quietly and think about what comes up in our mind about someone, that is, if we catch ourselves thinking of someone and their faults, it gives us the opportunity to become more aware of ourselves. And concerning why we are so concerned, and what does it really say about ourselves? Excuse me. Turn it around and wonder what could folks be saying about you? I got a kick out of a story about a fellow who was always coming up with new ideas for a business, one that he doesn't have to work too hard at. He finally decides his next venture will be to open a bar. All he's really concerned about is making some money. So he's bartending and he realizes how much people are gossiping at the bar. One of his friends, Megan, comes into the bar alone and asks him to dish the dirt. This really irritates him. And the next day she comes in and he says he's had it. He's closing the bar. She says, why? Is it money problems? Come on, you can tell me. I can keep a secret. He throws her out. In his book, Being Upright, Reb speaks of this precept and the dangers of slander. Now, this is an extreme of not speaking of others' faults and a good example of the real harm that can come from abusing this precept. When this precept gets multiplied nationwide, it can lead to wars. Whereas Dogen speaks of how beneficial speech can unite peoples. Reb uses the example of Iago in Shakespeare's Othello, where Iago is intentionally creating false impression of Desdemona as an unfaithful wife. This is an extreme example of slander where Othello doesn't doubt his so-called faithful servant, Iago, and eventually goes insane. It's the most over-the-top example of abusing the precept. But it's good to get the full scope of how our language and speech can both be helpful and harmful. So, how do we speak beneficially? We consider a person in their wholeness, with good wishes in our heart. We acknowledge a person's Buddha nature. I spoke of metta practice in the third precept as a healthy approach for dealing with difficult karma in our own and others. Perhaps if we will wish health and happiness for someone we have trouble seeing outside of their faults while we sit in metta meditation or Tonglin, we can begin the path towards following these precepts more fully. I'd like to quote from Norman's book, Taking Our Places Here. In fact, no matter what you say, in fact, no matter what you need to say to or about someone, in whatever circumstances, it is always possible and even necessary in the long run to speak from a heart of kindness and understanding. Even if you need to be critical or speak defensively, there's always a way to do it honestly and in a way that it does not express dislike, denigrate the other side, or enrage in person or engage in personal attack. For just as your speech conditions the experience of another person, it also conditions your own experience. So we are all shaped by our speech as well. However we express ourselves, we are creating some kind of karma. As Robin Wall Kimmerer closes a chapter in Service Berries, she cautions, every choice we make matters. That really struck me, even though all my training has taught me this. It's so easy not to be conscious of this with the constant barrage of choices we make. We are all engaged in this effort to be more conscious. They all matter. They all matter. I'm reminded of a story Norman told a couple of times many years ago about speaking. I'll preface this by a background of mine. Back in the 70s, I worked with Felicia Rice and her letter shop, printing press, as I was interested in printing. We were printing broadsheets of the poet William Everson, whose poetry I love. Everson also learned letterpress when he was a conscientious objector interned in Oregon. I first met him at a reading in the basement of the bookshop Santa Cruz, where he showed up in long white hair, long beard, and a fringed buckskin jacket. I thought he was right off an MGN movie lot. He was also known as Brother Antoninus when he lived in the Dominican monastery in the cliffs of Big Sur. When I knew him, he was lecturing at UC Santa Cruz and lived in a small A-frame in Swanton near Davenport. That A-frame must have seemed huge to him compared to his cell in the monastery. This was a monastery dedicated to silence. Yet he wrote the most beautiful erotic poetry while there. So Norman's story is about such a monastery where you spent your days in silent contemplation. Once a year, according to Norman, a monk was allowed to say a sentence briefly. So one year, the chosen monk said, I really hate the potatoes here. The next year, a monk stood up and said, I rather like our potatoes. On the third year, a disgruntled monk stood up and said, I can't stand all this bickering. I bring this story up because we're reflecting on right speech here. When I heard this story, I tried to imagine someone holding on to that thought for a year. Of course, this was facetious, but I wonder how long do we hold on to something we have heard? I probably heard that story 20 years ago. So, since everything we hear and can stay embedded as part of ourselves, let us try the practice of listening to things with a grain of salt instead of taking in things we hear as gospel truth. As I focus in on this precept, I'm reminded of how you can't really separate the precepts as separate concretized things. The previous precept, I'm not lying, ties inexorably to this precept. Not abusing the triple treasure is broken if we break this precept. By breaking this precept and speaking of the faults of others, we are also taking what is not given. You can imagine all the examples. The precepts are empty in the sense that everything and everyone is interconnected. We all have a family. The interconnection with everything means we're never alone in a forest. The precepts are, as a whole, our way of understanding and the way of our karmic activity. If you break one precept, you break them all. And we will. After all, we're human. In reading Okamura's book, Living by Vow, he speaks initially about what he wants to teach and how he wants to teach it. It raises the same question for me. What is it I want to teach, and how do I want to teach it? Of course, I want to teach the Buddha Dharma, but I also want to emphasize this interconnection with everything that we share. It's the appreciation of this and our sufficiency. We can cultivate our gratitude for the sufficiency we enjoy. Thank you very much. We'll now have a minute of silence until Alan comes on.
So, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are. I want to begin by talking a little bit about the precepts themselves and then about the specific precept that we're looking at today. Every time that I. Can you hear me? Yes. Yeah, okay. Every time I study the precepts with a group or read about the precepts myself, I'm just terrifically impressed by the opportunity that the precepts offer us to bring our lives into some kind of coherent order based on our feelings, our internal feelings. So I just wanted to say a little bit about the precepts, and I think about the opportunity that the precepts offer us. The theme of the precepts is to pay attention to what we do, to see how we cause suffering for ourselves and others, and how we can cause less suffering. Precepts offer a mixture of the Ten Commandments and the 12 steps. I'm really not an expert in either, but each one is a reckoning, an assessment of what we do and how we do it. It's the kind of reckoning that is not available to younger people who have not experienced the difficulties of adult life. The precepts allow us to take responsibility for how we are in the world. Maybe for the first time, not as victims blaming our parents and others, but as actors writing our own script and living it. Shohaku Okamura, in the book we're reading in seminar, says the consequences of our deeds cause suffering. When we clearly see our ignorance, it disappears. When we see with the eye of wisdom that ignorance causes suffering, we are free from both ignorance and suffering. This is called nirvana or enlightenment. As other aspects of the Buddhist path, this reckoning is dependent on our awareness, how well we're willing to look. But Buddha has left us an example of how he came to understand the meaning of his life, as he recommends that we discover the meaning of our own lives. Or Suzuki Roshi so wonderfully says, when you are you, Zen is Zen. So awareness is the key ingredient, seeing what we do. Zazen meditation is the place where it happens. The precepts provide a framework where blame and guilt are irrelevant, and the eye is focused on suffering in the present and how to prevent it. It's not our fault, but it is our responsibility to try to get it right. Please let me remind you that there is no concept of sin in Buddhism. One of the things that I think really attracted me to this way of life. And beautifully, there's no force or strong arming involved in this realization of no sin. If we see what we do and treat ourselves gently and without blame, with simple awareness, change occurs. Having identified what makes us uncomfortable and causes suffering, we remove the impetus and the behavior. It's a beautiful process taking place inside each one of us without force, guilt, or recrimination. And it's on your own schedule. You can see it as an opportunity and a structure to acknowledge and change what brings you suffering in your life. We come by our habits karmically, often from a young age. We are conditioned and we have learned the lessons, but now we have an opportunity to become our own teacher, live our lives according to our own realization of what we do. As Shohaku Okamura says, it's our choice to live by habit or by intention. Study of the precepts gives us that choice. So it's rare in life that we are offered the opportunity to practice, and rare that we have the chance to study precepts that illuminate our lives and offer the incredible and impossible opportunity to end suffering in our lives. And you are being offered this possibility. So that's what I wanted to say about the precepts. Every time I've studied the precepts, I'm just sort of dazzled by the offering that's being made to us, that here's a chance to take a look at what you do and change what you do, and change the tone of your life in the process. So to speak specifically about not speaking of the faults of others, I would just point out that complaining about others is really easy to do, too easy. And it can become habitual. We can think we are gaining something, indulging in criticism of others, but ultimately we diminish ourselves in our relationships. And criticizing others, pointing to the faults of others, is often about the feeling of scarcity in us, that there isn't enough love, not enough caring to make us feel valued. We can feel less than, we can feel insulted, criticized, and not seen. Most of us have been in this position in our lives at some time or other, and it causes suffering and it doesn't feel good. It's often an experience of childhood carried into adulthood and expressed as speaking of others' faults. And it has a distinctly karmic quality. The quality of comes from family and comes from early upbringing that we carry with us in a different form into adult life. So we try to make an alliance with a third party over the faults of a person that we're speaking about. And we think that that makes us bigger, but in the end, it doesn't work that way. In common, everyday experience, it is necessary to be aware of the destructive speech that we can easily indulge in. You know, I've heard, I don't know if you've heard this, but we have a number of millennials in our family, people born in the 80s, And I've noticed that they use this expression that they feel sometimes that they feel full. And I think what they mean by when they say that they feel full is they mean that it means that they feel emotionally satisfied, not that they need something else to make them feel whole. Dogen says in one of the fascicles, he says, when you find your place where you are, practice occurs. When you find your place where you are, practice occurs. I think this is a terrifically profound statement. He has a similar meaning in mind to when millennials talk about feeling full. And basically, what I think they're both saying is that when you feel satisfied, when you feel seen, when you feel appreciated for who you are, the feeling of scarcity that breeds, speaking of others' faults, vanishes. There's a space for the feeling of contentment, and there is no need to be critical of others to build up our own self-esteem. The incentive to speak of others' faults disappears when we feel full, when we find our place where we are. So much of Zen and Buddhist teaching is about how we make up our world in our attitudes and thoughts, and then we live in it. If we feel that scarcity of well-being, if we feel that scarcity of well-being, striking out and speaking of the faults of others is something we can easily fall into, it appears to make us feel better. But it's an illusion. It's an illusion that we all live. It may work for the moment in making us feel better, but in the long run, it's a losing game because it diminishes us all. Buddhism offers an alternative response, that of compassion and generosity. The precepts and what Buddhism calls the perfections that make up character, human character, emphasize generosity. When Buddhists talk of character attributes, generosity is usually at the top of the list. And in this case, it means generosity in how we regard others, even when we see faults that we can't avoid seeing. So what we're doing here is looking at our typical everyday responses to events and people in our lives. The precepts allow us the space to examine what we do and how we may be causing suffering inadvertently. Maybe even when we think we're helping, we're causing suffering. As you know by now, whenever Buddhists talk of wisdom, they are talking of compassion. In Buddhism, compassion always comes with wisdom. And compassion is the response when judgment and speaking to the faults of others appears. And thinking, being able to find our compassion at that moment is a very wise thing to do. It's a kind of training to see our own trigger points, to enter what Diane Rosetto, in her book, Waking Up to What We Do, calls the gap, or the space between something happening and our response to what has happened. So what I am suggesting is when we experience something in someone else that we don't like, instead of taking the stance of being critical, the moment can be seen as a teaching or a learning moment to take the backward step of asking, what is it in us that is being offended? We can't choose our feelings, but we can choose how to respond to our feelings. We are all taught judgmental behavior at some point, and judgments are necessary. Judgments keep us safe and out of trouble. To be able to identify things that can hurt us is a basic function of judgment. As our study of the precepts and awareness of how we feel, how we are in the world, increases, we begin to separate judgments based on reality or safety and judgments based on preferences or unimportant differences. I was raised in an environment where judgments about others' sincerity or authenticity were often made. One small response I've learned over the years is to regard my judgments, which maybe previously in my life might have closed me off to people, to just see my judgments as annoyances. And you know, when I see them as annoyances, I think to myself, that's no big deal. I'm annoyed. So what? It's allowed me to feel freer and to take my judgments that spontaneously appear, even though I resist them, less seriously. An annoyance is very different from a potential rejection and keeps channels that might otherwise be closed open. So I encourage you, when you find yourself having some judgmental attitude about a person or what you're seeing, to first, before you jump into, oh, this is serious, say, you know, I'm annoyed. Big deal. I often think of Martin Buber's words in his great essay, I and Thou, where he distinguishes treating those we are relating to as beings with dignity or as objects. So the thou means that we're offering people intimacy, that we're offering to see them clearly as who they are, as opposed to as objects to be manipulated. He uses the term thou to illustrate respect and potential intimacy with others rather than as others or objects. A very meaningful distinction. But unfortunately, we are a nation that has been systematically critical of those different from the imagined us throughout our history. The United States practiced slavery of humans. We thought Irish and Southern Europeans inferior to Northern Europeans. We tried to exclude Chinese from our country, and we incarcerated loyal Japanese citizens who had been here for generations during World War II. Racism and discrimination against those different from us trying to enter our country to improve the lives of their families has been a constant occurrence in the history of this country. We are all witnessing the fabrication of charges of corruption and crime of those immigrants for the political gain right now of those in power, a manipulation to try to get us to condemn people that we know nothing about so other people can gain political power as a result. So speaking of others' faults can be used personally and politically for advantage and potential persecution. It's a slippery subject. Caution is advised. So I think we've got a minute of silence. Oh my goodness, I finished right on the minute. Anyway, so let's take a minute of silence and then we'll have breakout groups and talk about what comes up for you.